This episode of the Builder Sessions is brought to you by Grind Coffee Co.
Hey, this is Dennis Scott from Humblebee Builds, and you're listening to the Builder Sessions.
Welcome to the Builder Sessions, a podcast where we chat with your favorite builders.
We get to know them, their stories, and hopefully inspire you to get off the couch and build something cool. I'm Hoff.
And I'm Rosie.
And on this episode, we chat with Dennis Scott from Humblebee Builds. We chat about his creative process from design to install, the important role good mentors play in helping young people grow into successful craftsmen, and we dive into his new tiny home build and the unique features that it has.
Please enjoy our interview with Dennis. Dennis, welcome to the Builder Sessions.
Thank you.
It's awesome to have you. I mean, Hoff's talking my ear off about you. Oh, yes. We got to get this guy on. I worked with him, and he's doing some really awesome stuff. For those of our listeners who aren't quite aware of who you are and what you're up to, tell us a little about yourself.
So my name is Dennis Scott. I am the owner of DC Sky Construction. Is kind of what we do on our day-to-day right now. I'm also the owner of Humblebee Builds Tiny Home Construction. So I started off in cabinet shops. Originally I wanted to build furniture for a living, and I thought that the cabinet shops would be my avenue to that. But I found out very quickly that cabinet shops are very manufactured based, and it's a lot of standing in one place all day long. Mm. And it was kind of not what I wanted. So the company I worked for at the time, it was two brothers. One brother kind of did the front end, and the other brother did the back end. He was also their installer. And the installation part of it was what I really enjoyed the most, because it was a lot of like creativity that was involved in the installation process. But that position wasn't available. I got to do a little bit of it, but not a lot. So I decided to go out on my own so that I could dictate what I did day to day. That was, 2006. So 18 years ago. Is that right?
No, 2007 or 2008, I think, because we worked at the shop for a year and a half or a year together. Then you went on your own.
But all the 15 years or more, that's a long time ago. Jeepers.
Just hitting you now. Oh, man.
And so, yeah, that led to a lot of different avenues and types of work. I've done everything from concrete work all the way to some roofing and everything in between. So it's been crazy every day ever since. You know, this industry is always booming, especially in Canada and especially in the Kootenays, where I'm from. And it's been exciting every day. I enjoy going to work every day.
The change, hey? I remember, yeah. So I guess for our listeners that don't know, you left the cabinet shop. I think I finished my apprenticeship, and then I started with you in February of 2011, and I think I put in 6 months before we got married. Remember, I came and worked full-time, and then after that, you helped pay for my university by coming back for the summers. And what I remember about it, and I probably you could speak to this too, is the change in jobs, right? I remember tiling, hardwood flooring, laminate, custom showers. Like you said, that creative side on the installation is really cool when you can get different jobs and put your own touch on, and you're not having somebody tell you what to do or, hey, this needs to look this way. And I think over time you've built up your clientele where they just give you that creative freedom to be able to, you know, do the designs and tiling and all this other stuff. Can you talk a bit about that? Like creative process, I guess, and how that kind of maybe drives you day to day?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I myself tend to kind of seek out a little bit of that type of person. I really like to work for clients who know a little bit about what they want, but need guidance and how to get there. I find that the clients that know exactly what they want, it ends up just being an install job. Mm. Where, you know, when we're working with a client that is open to ideas, open to design, and open to time frame in a sense, they tend to get a much better product in the end. Mm. The creative side of it was, like I said, you know, with the cabinet shop, that's what it really lacked and what I really sought for. So I've developed my business based around the ability to maneuver and change when things start getting stagnant or, you know, just constant. I tend to make a left turn and try something different. You know, at one point, I think you might have even been with me, I started taking turns into like cultured stone. You know, mm-hmm. we started doing exterior work just because, you know, the day-to-day just started getting kind of mundane. And that was the whole idea of taking on my business on my own, was my ability to be able to just kind of maneuver in the direction that I wanted to in the moment. And the beauty of the construction industry is it's pretty vast. There's many jobs to be done, many types of things that have to be done. So I worked a lot with a hotel chain called the Prestige Hotels over the years. In the beginning, they had us do quite a lot of the renovation. And so it gave me a base knowledge. Like say, for example, with the electricians or the plumbers, they would bring in like one guy and then I would help him do those type of things. It's kind of a mini apprenticeship. And so that really gave me a base of knowledge for a wider spectrum of how to do things when it came to renovations, like full renovations.
Yeah.
And then over the years that relationship built, and now we're doing like full, like last year we did a complete gut and redo of the Nelson Prestige lobby.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was a really amazing project and I had a blast doing it. It was hard to be away from the family. I was 2 weeks on, 1 week off. I had two crews, so me and then another crew, and we kind of jumped back and forth with each other. But I had full control over it, you know, dealing with the plumbers, the electricians, everybody that was involved in it. It was a very expensive renovation and, it was just really cool to be a part and in control of something like that. It gave me a lot of creative freedom to be able to do some things that in a way, and I have a really good example of that. So when we, good old TikTok, when we, the designer wanted, drywall beams done in the roof. And then she wanted a post and beam construction on two of the beams. So there's 12 beams, 6 feet apart that were right against the roof. And then two sections that came down in Vs with a center pillar and the beam that went across like a 30-foot span. She wanted them wrapped in drywall. She didn't want them to be a wood or a faux or painted wood. She wanted them to be drywall because she wanted them completely matte, like completely flat and matte finish. So, we started to figure out how to router and fold the drywall so we didn't have to put corner beads on all of the boxes. So we'd router them all the way down, then we'd scrape them to the paper, then we'd put spray foam construction in, fold them, tape them, and then we didn't have to do any corner beads. So like things like that, that's my passion, is figuring out how to make things easier and more systematic.
That's cool. Problem solving.
Do you just paint that after that's all done? Yeah. And you don't have to worry about mudding and taping, and probably a cleaner product.
Yeah, absolutely. And squares, right? Because you're not putting a corner bead on and feathering out, you know, 6 inches, creating kind of a concave look. Mm-hmm. It's just a straight square. And then we made skeletons, like a 3/8 plywood with a cross members in the middle with 2x2s, and made these skeletons that we hung from the roof. And then it was just like a sleeve that slipped over top of them and then caulked them to the roof. And when it came to like the posts that came down, the Vs, we had to drywall and corner bead all of those because it was very difficult to fold four sides and fold the last 45 into it. It wasn't working. So we ended up corner beating those, but the U's worked amazing, and it just made it a lot simpler. It was a challenge, but I think that it saved us a lot of time in the end. But those are the type of thing. Those are the type of things I look for when I'm looking for work, or very different projects that I haven't done a million times.
Think outside the box. I remember being being at the hotels there, and the repetition and the monotonous work sometimes gets to you. But at the same time, if you take a look back long term, even looking back now, all the tiling, and I think I did a whole bunch of the doors. We were doing all the making the closet doors and hanging them. After about 10 or 15 doors out of 30 or 40, you get into repetition where you can, you know, do it quicker, and you can kind of find shortcuts that probably now, looking back to what you do and having the electrical, plumbing, tiling, all that stuff, probably makes you more well-rounded to be able to tackle a job and to say, hey, I'm going to try and cut this drywall and fold it around instead of just slapping on corner beads. And, you know, like, it almost gets you to think outside the box because you have this big skill set of jobs that maybe at the time weren't creative, but they give you kind of a baseline to move forward and apply those to your problem solving toolbox, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was one of the biggest things. And that's one of the things that why I want to get into a more manufactured situation, is because over the years of being in the hotels and doing 110 bathrooms, you know, one after the other in the exact same manner, you really develop systems and the ability to create systems and make things move a lot quicker, right down to like how you lay out the toilet parts when you're putting them together in the 10 rooms you're working on, and or the parts you need in the moment to do a certain aspect of the job on your cart and ready to go. And you really hone your skills and ability when you do it that many times over and over again in the course of a certain amount of time. But it, like you said, it's hard. After 99 rooms, you're just so done with it. And you say you never do it again, but then 3 months later they call and they're like, hey, come do 90 rooms in Kelowna. And you're like, all right, let's do it. Like you said, afterwards you look back and you're like, you know what? It really was super beneficial in certain aspects. It was hard and grinding, but it wasn't, it was very beneficial to your skills and ability.
So for someone like me who has no clue what you're talking about, what's a corner joint? What did you call it?
Corner bead?
A corner bead. What's a corner bead?
It's a paper. What comes in multiple ways, so you can get it in metal. Like that's what an old school kind of 80s, 70s house would have.
Like where it corners the drywall
when
it comes
steel,
to like a
and then now they have plastic, and then they have paper as well. And that's when you, in a corner of the drywall, you would mud that onto it to create a more structural form, so that when it gets bumped or when it gets banged, it's more solid.
I don't want to just sit here and pretend, oh, yeah, totally.
we each have our strengths and weaknesses.
Like,
hey?
When I'm talking cars with someone.
Yeah, hey, I'm just like, what? Hey. I don't know anything about cars.
Exactly. We're learning. So, Dennis, I want to take a step back. How did you get into this? Like, what was the, was it a shop class? Was it, you know, was it like working with your dad or an uncle, or, you know, how did you have the desire to get into your field? And then how did you get to where you're at? Like what steps did you take? Did you do an apprenticeship somewhere? Like what was your journey that way?
So I kind of knew exactly what I wanted to do my entire life. When I was young, my mom, and uncle would take a 2x4 and just put nails in it and then give me a hammer. And I would sit there and pound them in for hours. My uncle owned a little woodwork shop. He had a garage in his house, and I spent a lot of time working in there with him and just being around it. I really enjoyed the noise of the machines. I sleep at night with white noise. And so, you know, it was kind of just this comfort thing, when I got into junior high and I hit the shops, it was just like a dream come true. I couldn't get drug out of it. Mr. Fanning at Laurie was one of my teachers, and then Paul Duchek at Baker. And those men really just created a passion for me in it. I was naturally more advanced than most of the kids in my class. And both those men just kind of gave me freedom to do what I wanted. Right away, they could see that I was capable and able to kind of maintain safety, and knew a little bit of what I was doing, and they would guide me. But Paul, especially in grade 12, 11, 12, he just kind of let me do and build whatever I wanted. And so, when I left high school, I went to Edmonton, and just, I was a young adult, and I was just, I played for 2 years and didn't really do anything. And I really yearned to get back into that shop, and I wanted to do that as my avenue. So I enrolled in UBC in Kelowna, or not UBC, what is it? Is that right?
Okanagan Kelowna? College?
Yeah, that one, yeah, Okanagan yeah. College yeah. University. Yeah. Whatever. Just so I could get into the shop. I paid the $10,000 tuition. It gave me my first year apprenticeship in carpentry and joinery. I didn't really feel like I needed it. It's not really like, I didn't think that I would need an apprenticeship to get where I wanted to go. I didn't really know. Mm-hmm. And then I met Les, my teacher, and he was a huge driving force. A great man. He was part of developing the R2000 home, one of the first high efficiency homes developed in our country. He was on the board of creating that. And I came into his life moments after that was done. So, you know, the innovation in his mind, just really stirred on me. And I wanted to, plus he was a huge advocate about aging tradesmen. Like this was in 2003. And this guy is talking about, you know, something that's 10 years, 15 years, 20 years down the road. But he would tell us every day, you need to start a business in this industry. You need to do it as soon as you're done here. There is so much opportunity for you in the next 10 to 15 years. And, you know, that just always rang in my head. But it's hard when you're very young and you come out of a pizza joint, that's your job, and to start a business. Right. So, I had delivered pizzas to Gitman's when I was in grade 11, maybe in the summer. And I like walked into his shop, and I didn't know it was his shop. He has a bigger shop now, but his old shop was in between two houses. Like it was in the middle of a neighborhood, but it was a full on like joinery shop. And I didn't know it existed. And I delivered pizzas there, and I was like, what is this place? And he brought me in and he showed me around. He was super nice. So it was my first door I knocked on.
That's cool.
And he hired me right away, just because he said it was because of my like twinkle in my eye when I came that day. You know, he just knew that there was something about me that would like, he could definitely have around his shop. But I made a big mistake. I got offered more money as a young kid and a different position. And I left there to go to Cranbrook Woodwork Interior, and it didn't work out. The people that were there and just the atmosphere, and it just wasn't for me. And so then I became a baker, and I worked at Safeway for 2 years, maybe a little less, a year or so. And then A1 Tops picked me up, and I did on my own. I learned how to build countertops and laminate, work with laminate. And then Gerald approached me again another time and said, hey, we're looking for a laminate guy. We just bought all this equipment. Do you want to come back? And then I came back. And then I think that was when I met you the first time. Yep. Was when I came back.
Yeah.
Or were you there the first time?
No.
Because Junior was still in school, I think.
2007. Yeah.
Yeah. You guys would have been like high school, I think, when I came back that first time. So the second time is when we met, and we buried your car in snow that time. You remember that?
Okay. Yeah, hold on. Let's talk about that for a second.
How mad
was he? Okay, let's talk about this. So livid. What happened?
So I think we were in an install in Fernie.
Oh, I love it.
At the Fernie, hill. You're far away. Yeah.
Far away. And I had an old, I think it was like a 97 Hyundai Elantra. It was just a piece of crap. And I came home. I think it was a little bit of a later shift. I think we got in at 6 or 7 p.m.
And yeah. My car was so tired.
Yeah. My car was loaded of snow up and over it. It looked like a snowbank. And I had to dig it.
Oh, you were so mad.
I was so livid. It was a grind day too. I remember, I think we got on the road at 6 a.m. and it's like an hour and a little bit each way. And,
That's how you know that they like you though, you know?
Here's the first year. What would that been? Maybe second year apprentice, just going through the workforce.
I would have loved to see that. Get him all wound up.
Looking back, it was hilarious, but at the time, I was pissed. Yeah, I was pissed. I think Danny actually helped me. Didn't you help me shovel it out?
Yeah, because I did help. Yeah, I stayed. I came back. I had Art tell me when you got there, and I came back. But the hard part was every time we thought it was out, it wasn't.
That's because the tires were like bald summers there. It was my first car, and just spinning. So good times.
Okay. Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So that's kind of my backstory. And it just led to like really fun and exciting things. And like I said before, I absolutely love what I do every day. And I love the creative side of it. And I have a pretty good time most days. I mean, some days are hard, but most days we have a pretty good time at work.
Do you ever you keep in touch with the guy that you deliver pizzas to?
Yeah, I do. I go sit with him every once in a while.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Because when you said that, how you said it, you said I made a big mistake and then I left for more money. I wanted to know what happened after that.
I came back.
Yeah.
After years, yeah.
Oh, that's who you came back to.
Yeah, I came back to that cabinet shop. Yeah.
Nice. Well, that's good. And
I was older and wiser and, you know, smarter. And then I left him again to start my business.
And shortly after, I left and joined you.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
I finished my apprenticeship and then
went to Geralt.
So you mentioned this is kind of interesting because Rosie and I are both shop teachers here, welding and woodworking. You had a couple very influential kind of mentor teachers. Looking back, how did that? What am I trying? I guess I'm trying to like how influential and important. Is our mentors, whether you're young and old, but to have somebody to kind of mentor you and teach you, and in your instance, kind of, I guess, maybe give you a little bit more flexibility based on your skill set. Did that allow you to really thrive and help you out, I guess, to get into this?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. And the funny thing is both of those people didn't really there wasn't an effort for them to do what they were doing. It was just them doing their job every day in an industry that I loved, you know, the time that they put into cleaning the shop after hours and, you know, like you can just see it. But you know, when you go to sit in a history class, you don't really like notice like the work that's put into that classroom. You're just in a classroom, but because I was so ingrained in woodwork and just absolutely loved it and adored it, I could see the effort that Paul and Mr. Fanning would put into their shop and the time that was spent to it. And I think it really kind of just was one of those things that not everybody sees that person or comes across that person the same way as somebody else. Mm-hmm. It was a little bit of circumstance, the mindset that I had, where I came from. That really kind of drove that mentorship that they gave me in high school. And it's a basis to what you kind of lead to. It was so long ago. It was just so long ago. I was such an old man, but I'm not. But I feel I don't know. Now you start thinking you're 41. That was 22 years ago. Jesus.
Wow. Yeah. It's interesting because we have kind of similar stories with the, because right off the bat, I knew I wanted to be in some sort of woodworking, being kind of involved with my parents and stuff. And I went through Baker and Cranbrook too. And I remember Paul being just, and I still keep in touch. That's who I went to BC to hang out with a couple weeks ago. I spent a couple nights with him and he's still the same guy. And I remember being just a young kid and just the mentorship and the passion that he had of the trades and getting, you know, sharing his passion and getting people into it. It's just, I don't know. It's one of those moments when I got into teaching, it was kind of, you know, everybody's asking, hey, how'd you get into teaching? You know, did you know right away? And it's like, not really, but the mentor, and I had another one in Okotoks, but just the shop teachers and being, and similar, seeing the work that they did, the cleaning of the shop, the organization. I feel like, you know, we do a lot of that. And sometimes you don't necessarily see the impact until maybe you talk to students down the road or whatnot. But I don't know, that high school can be a very influential time in somebody's life. Obviously people get into it older too, and hopefully they can get mentors, but I don't know, that moldable age of being a teenager and, you know, grade 10 to 12 and even middle school. I think shop teachers can play, and some can't, but I think a lot can, you know, play a very pivotal role mm-hmm. in the trajectory, whether it's trades or not, but just having a teacher who's there, who's pumped up all the time, you know, just wants to have fun and hopefully kind of inspire you to do what you want to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know. Sometimes I forget how influential, like, even a word we say can be. Like what you said, Dennis, about how that one teacher is just doing their job, right? There's been a couple times, I get this, both of us have had yeah. situations where we're just showing up to work and doing this and whatever, and all of a sudden these kids are, you know, saying, hey, thanks for this, blah, 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 or you're the reason that this happened, blah, blah, blah. I was just showing up. Yeah. So it's really, so thanks for that reminder for me. You're like, okay, yeah, when I'm not feeling it, like there's kids there that are looking to me perhaps for some more mentorship, and I got to, you know.
Step up a bit.
Not be, yeah. No, I have a lot of fun in my class.
But it's almost the other side of it. You mentioned the cleaning the shop and stuff. I just, for example, this weekend I made a clamp cart for a bunch of F clamps on a mobile base and stuff. And I had a bunch of students come in today and we're like, oh, I see you made this. Like, when did you do this? I said, oh, Friday. And I came in Saturday. They're like, oh, this is awesome. It's going to, you know, give a spot for all the clamps to go. It's mobile. Like they appreciate it and they're kind of into it. And just little things that some kids are totally aware of that. And some could give a rat's ass. Like, what is this thing taking up space, right? But there's so many different avenues, and you know. And then I remember working with you when you first got your trailer and the 15 different layouts. Like you organized your trailer with, you know, your table saw, and everything had a place for it. And I think that speaks volumes with when we talk about efficiency, developing systems, right? I mean, that organization part, I think. Speaking from, I guess, being around it a lot, my dad was a organizational freak in the garage, but you can, especially when you're in a mobile trailer.
Have you seen your garage?
Yeah.
When
you see a mobile trailer or a work crew coming up, some trailers are totally decked out and designed properly. Some just toss them into boxes. And working with you, I could see the passion and the need for having this system in place to be able to do the work properly and on time. And you know, because it was, everything was labeled, everything had a spot, you could work out of your trailer, you could haul it all out to site. Like that stuff just goes miles, I think.
Yeah, I'm always looking for ways to make things easier on myself. I don't want to go to work. And so when I show up in the day, I want to try to eliminate as many headaches as possible. And I always knew from the beginning that organization of my tools or place things set up as much as I could would eliminate, you know, as much headache as I possibly could. And I do that in a lot of the systems that I do. We're tiling a floor right now, and I have a guy who's with me, and he's pretty new. He's got some experience, but I find myself really focusing on what I hated about tile in the beginning was the thin set on my body, like the thin set on my hands. You definitely
yes.
know. You're the girl on princess because you had to wash your hands all the time.
It's just like working on a car. If my hands get greasy, it's something about the dirty hands.
Do you have any gloves?
Yeah. I would dry out my hands and the I just hated it. Thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah, no problem. And so
he used to call him princess. That's why they buried your car.
Yeah.
And so like today I was just noticing on how like I was really guiding him on like using the appropriate tools to get the mud out of the bucket instead of dipping the trowel, and just ways, because you know, when you tile for sure, you are a lot less or a lot more calm and a lot more focused if you're not covered in the stuff and the walls aren't covered in the stuff. And so it takes time to be able to do that though. Like you have to take the moment to think about the fact that you should reach into the bucket with the scoop or that you should scrape the sides of the bucket down all the time, or you should always have a rag with you and wiping all your joints, or because then leading forward, it just makes a cleaner job from, you know, things you do now when you go to do the grouting, for example, or, you know, kick your tile spacers, cleaner from the beginning makes the job easier along the way. And that's been like one of my biggest focuses on my day to day is, like I said, trying to eliminate the really minor stresses that might be in a day, like a dirty hands or frustration of having to clean or whatever it may be, just the simple things I knew that I could control.
Very intentional. Hey, going in instead of just shooting from the hip, going in whatever this day brings, you know, you're controlling that day, you're controlling what you can control.
That's right.
That's cool. Yeah, I like that.
And that kind of what led me to decide, like, so with all this we've talked about, you know, that's what's leading me towards the tiny home construction.
Okay, let's go into that.
Yeah, sure. So Humblebee is about a year old. We're just finishing up. I'm still working on it a little bit, but we just finished building our first prototype, I'm calling it. It was my first build. It's being built for a man in Qualicum Beach. He's purchased it. He's a friend of, like a friend of the family's. He was at the house one night, and when we were just starting it, I had the trailer and I was doing the design. And he absolutely just like got so excited about this idea.
That's awesome.
And, he's like, I want to buy this one. And I said, no, no, you can't. Like, I don't want to sell it. I don't like the whole idea for this first one was for DC Scott to fund it so we could build it the way we wanted to build it, install and put in the things that we wanted to do on it. And also as like a learning curve, we wanted to do it ourselves the first time because we knew that there was going to be a lot of roadblocks along the way that we needed to learn about. I didn't want to try to sell one to somebody not knowing about certification, not knowing about insurance, not knowing about places to put them, all of those things.
Yeah, like, so do codes apply to that? Or what codes
that's
apply?
That's right. Like, what
is it
takes.
A home or is it an RV? Like, all that kind of stuff, I'm sure is
a it's such a gray, cloudy industry. But, you know, I knew that I wouldn't be able to ask the questions without them arising during a construction type situation. I knew I wouldn't be able to sit down at the computer for hours and come up with the answers to everything because I didn't know the questions that needed to be asked yet. But it was a blessing because he, you know, he took a lot of financial stress out of the equation. You know, I didn't have to scramble to find money to buy the stove or to, well, not scramble, but I didn't have to like get the money to do it. And he gave me total freedom. You know, he said, whatever you want to do. He's like, I want this thing to have everything a tiny home could have in it. Look, dream, figure it out, do whatever you want, take as much time as you want.
It was really cool.
So we built our first one. We call it the Chef because it naturally became a kitchen on wheels. Because that's what I do. My kitchen background just kind of led my design to lots of cabinets. And then, you know, so then we started looking at ways to, we said, well, how can we elevate this throw to something that, you know, maybe isn't common, you know, that, you know, because tiny houses are becoming more common. You know, if you see a tiny home online, you look at it and you say, oh, that's your typical tiny home. Well, 10 years ago, that wasn't the case. There was no typical tiny home. But now, you know, there's multiple manufacturers in our region. One really cool thing I found out about tiny homes is that there's two main places that they're built in the world. It's funny how industry kind of breeds within. It's almost like a magnet. Oregon is one of them. Portland, Oregon has a lot of builders that build tiny homes. There's a lot of companies there. And Vancouver Island is the next one, you know, when it comes to per capita and the amount of builders.
Oh, wow.
You know, so, yeah. But it's fitting because both those areas are very similar in geography and type. But yeah, so when we started building this, we thought, how can we elevate this? And so our first thought was, you know, let's try to build it sustainably as we can. Let's try and buy our products locally close by, and focus on carbon footprints. You know, how did that thing get here? And then with that came, who are we supporting with our purchases? You know, are we supporting Jeff Bezos and Amazon, or are we supporting, not that I didn't buy things from Amazon, because it is very hard to find certain things, especially when you're being creative.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can't just go to the hardware store in Cranbrook, the town of 30,000 people, and buy this thing that you dreamt up. You know, you have to do some research. There's a lot of nights that I spent online trying to find this certain thing that I had in mind. For example, the plumbing manifold. I didn't want to run the plumbing in that tiny home, teeing it off of one solid line, which is typically how they're done. I wanted to incorporate a plumbing manifold into the tiny house. In a tiny home, you don't have a lot of space. So I couldn't build like a wall structured manifold, you know, kind of creating it on my own. So I had to find a manifold that was small and well built and good quality. And so like, those are the type of things that I had to buy. So then we bought rock wool, because it's made in Grand Forks, and Camfor 2x4s, because they were built locally. We made sure they came from a mill, Radium Elko, one of the more closer mills. So we did a lot of that, as much as we could. We wrapped the whole thing in steel. We bought the steel from a local supplier, but they make them so it comes off of a roll, and then they manufacture the raised the steel into the shape that you want it to be. We focused really a lot on trying to buy our product as local as we could and support the local community in the best way that we could. And so then as we found things that we couldn't buy, like I talked about the manifold, that's kind of where this was leading to. We started to devise, like, as we're building our business plan for Humblebee, we started looking at ways of how can we counteract that sustainability? Like, how can we still be able to purchase fridge or stove that's made in China or Korea? Like, because you have to. There's not a lot of Canadian fridges, right? So we came up with an idea. So it's not a new idea, but we are going to sell like t-shirts and hoodies and hats, and then give all of the proceed to a bee foundation of some sort, something that helps the environment. So we want to take some of our profits, a percentage of our profits, and donate them back to counteract, you know, that carbon footprint that we create in building.
That's awesome.
Yeah, we thought so too. You know, I really think that, it all evolved from the fact that as you get into this industry, you start to realize that, you know, it's about living in a minimal situation. It's about trying to have the least amount of impact on the environment. But at that same time, we still have to make money. We still have to do our jobs. We still have to live our lives. So, you know, but I'm a strong believer in an equal balance. There's ways and things that we can all do in our day-to-day lives that can make a difference, even if it's not the biggest difference, but it can be make a difference. So that's kind of what we wanted to do when it came to that part. And then another thing that when we started building this, trying to make it different and unique, we decided that we would build it 100% off the grid. So the chef can be parked in a bush, and it collects rainwater. It has a rainwater catchment system.
That's awesome.
So we kind of came up
so sweet.
With a system on our own. So, you know, and those things are the things that really drove me and excited me about doing this, is being able to have a little bit of freedom to be able to kind of come up with ideas on my own and see if they work. And, you know, our rain catchment system is a guttered system, that we put, like foam in, like gutter foam, and then it runs all together into one system, and then it runs into 1,000 liter tank that has a filter on it, again, a second filter, and then it gets pumped out of that tank in through another charcoal filter and then can go right back into your holding tanks, your freshwater holding tanks.
That's amazing.
Talk about creative mindset right there. Hey, let's just design a tiny home that can be parked at your, you know, your California resort parking pad, or you can go take it up a logging road and go park it up in the mountain and go live off grid. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is cool. And it's what's really cool in doing this is that I was able to find a lot of, there's a lot of like-minded industry out there. You know, the lithium-ion battery has evolved substantially over the last 5 years. We chose a company called Blue Eddy. There's a lot of companies out there that have created these batteries. Now, I don't believe that lithium-ion batteries are a sustainable choice in an alternative fuel system or storage system. I think that there's going to be better things that come along with it. But gas was dirty in the beginning too, and it's they figured out we hit a lot better, not perfect, but a lot better oil and stuff. But so we chose Blue Eddy. They have an amazing system. I bought the AC300. So what it is it's a controller pack. It looks like a ghetto, and then it comes with two lithium ion batteries that are inside two packs that sit on top of the controller pack. The controller pack does everything. It's a computer for it. So it monitors its temperatures. It monitors the lithium's battery's temperatures. It alerts you if there's any issues with them. And they will give me, so each of those battery packs will give me 3 kilowatt hours. And we calculated that the tiny home needed 10. I only put 2 in this because it's kind of a show home. Like Ken won't really ever use this as a living situation. So we didn't put the full amount of batteries, but you can have up to 4 of them. So you can have up to 12 kilowatt hours.
Wow.
Yeah, totally. And so it's really crazy. And then, so, with that, so we calculated 10 is what we needed to run the tiny home all day. And then, so like when I started talking about this, people were asking, well, how will it be powered during like cloudy days? Like, how would that work? So then we started looking into solar panels, and like we started at the top, like what are the like best generating solar panels in a smaller form, because we only have so much space. So we went with 4 monocrystal, I think they're called. So the way a solar panel works is it's kind of like a TV over the years, where it went from like 720 pixels per square inch to 10,000 and so, or 1080 and then so on and so forth. With solar panels, that's kind of what's happening. As they create more cells within the smaller space, they can give you more wattage.
Mm-hmm.
With 4, so we have 1200 watts of solar panel, and then we have an array of 2 more. So the batteries can take 16. The batteries can take 24. So there's 2 panels that sit in an array that get plugged in, and then the 4 on the roof. So on a sunny day, those batteries only take 2.5 hours to charge.
Wow.
So that's pretty crazy.
That's amazing. And how long on like a cloudy day, just like average use, not charging, but average use, how long does it take to kind of run them down?
It would be the day.
Oh, okay.
But the cool thing is on a daily basis, you're not using those 10 kilowatt hours every day all the time.
Yeah.
In our calculations, we won't know until it's like tested and lived in, but we figure that we probably could be like a 2-day span without charging the batteries, maybe a little
That's
more.
Cool. And then if not, I mean, you always got your diesel generator sitting in the back, right?
Yeah. So sustainable.
Yeah.
Glug, glug, glug.
Just...
So the off the grid option, and then we chose, there's many options for toilets and stuff too. Like you can go compostable. You can go with an incinerator, and then you can go with tanks like an RV. We found that incinerating toilet would draw way too much power, so it's actually not a great off the grid option.
I always wondered about those.
Yeah, and they're massive. They're like
Are
a
they?
Lazy boy.
Really.
$1,000. I guess it's crazy.
So you went compost?
Yeah, pardon?
Did you go with compost?
Tanks.
Oh, tanks.
we felt that it was because people are pretty common with like an RV.
Yeah.
And they're used to that. And there's a lot of resources for emptying the tanks. Like when it comes to the black water, the gray water is a lot easier. If you're living off the grid and you have a property, you can do gravel pits and be able to put your gray water away into them. But the black water, there's, you know, you can have someone empty them for you, but there's also lots of options when it comes to totable totes. So like totes on wheels, you can pull behind your car so that you can empty them on your own. And then we have our fresh water holding tanks. We have 80 gallons, then 40 and 44 and 44. And like I said, we just, a lot of it was based around what I knew, what I, you know, we've had a camper for a lot of years and we use them and lots of people know them and they're common and they're comfortable with them. And then, so after we did that and we decided that's what we were going to do, we looked at more options of how to kind of elevate it. So we wrapped in steel, like I said earlier, so then it will last forever. It'll look exactly the same. There's very little wood product on the outside. It's all, like a steel roofing product that we used on the sides and top. And then we started thinking about like, what is trouble in our home? Like if someone's going to live in a tiny house, you know, how can we make living in this tiny house easier? Again, going back to like how I think about work, you know, how can I eliminate headaches? And so we started to design the one thing about the tiny home that I wasn't a big fan of, the typical tiny home or the common tiny home, is that the mechanical is kind of put in places around the tiny home. So your hot water tank will be under in a closet on the floor, or your electrical panel will be in the bathroom on the wall, or, you know, so what I wanted to do is I wanted to create a tiny mechanical room. So I took 2 feet of, yeah, totally. And that's my favorite part of the tiny home. It ended up being is this mechanical room. So in this mechanical room, we managed to put our hot water on demand. So we have a propane 5.5 gallon per minute hot water on demand. And then the plumbing manifold is in there. And then the batteries and the controllers in there. Those sit on top of the freshwater tank, which below on the other side with a panel you lift off, there's the pump is there for the water pump, the 5.5 gallon water pump. And then our air exchanger is also in there. And the air exchanger was like by far my favorite part, because when we started looking at what we wanted to put into this mechanical room, we decided that an air exchanger was pretty important, because this thing is a balloon. It's totally sealed 100%. There's nowhere for air to escape. Really? We sealed everything as many times as we could to make sure that it was totally sealed, because we wanted to control the environment inside. We felt like, you know, because it's such a small space and the people who are living in it, are living maybe together or with multiple families, we want to make sure that our tiny homes are healthy as well, as sustainable. So not just healthy to the environment, but healthy to the person. So it's really neat, because when you take a 300 square foot home, it really doesn't take much effort to be able to create and change the environment that they live in. So those were just like, those are some of the things that we kind of journeyed through when in the actual design and build of this first tiny home, and what we will lead to in the future, taking these ideas and applying them to different ones.
It sounds like you were just nerding it up on the old internet there, and with all the different like air exchangers, a mechanical room and a tiny home. I mean, I haven't looked in a ton of tiny homes, but I've kind of been browsing a little bit, and it sounds like you've got some kind of unique ideas that I think maybe not a lot of people think of off the grid tiny homes, more of, you know, park it on a piece of land, run power to it. So I think having that flexibility and being able to be off the grid or on can be really, really beneficial. We talked a little bit before about, you talked about certification, codes and stuff. Was that a bit of a nightmare, or was it just a lot of research on your part to get up to date with? Have you had to get any certifications? How has like the paperwork and the design part been for you?
So when it comes to the certification, this is just my opinion. This isn't how everybody feels about it, especially a lot of people who are in the industry now. I feel like, so there's multiple ways to certify your tiny home. The most common way is through CSA. And most of the time you go through a third party, like a company called Intertech. And so the way that works is they come and they certify your shop. They come and they meet you. They see how you build them. They see the first build. They follow you through the first build. And then they certify you as a builder. You get a book of tickets. Mm-hmm. Now you get to build as many as you want up to the 6 month point where they come again and they do a walkthrough. So Humble Bee could build 10 to 15 tiny homes without an inspector looking at them. Mm. They look at one, they look at 16, they look at 30.
Yeah.
They don't look at all of them.
Okay.
And so, you know, but that's kind of the way the system was set up. They, you know, they took the RV and park model models of certification and they applied them to the tiny home because they had to apply them. They had to do something because people, it was getting popular. More and more people were building them. Insurance companies did not want to insure them, but they were forced to find an avenue to do it. And so they grabbed on to this, what I call the old boys club of certification. These certifications were developed many years ago. They were developed for an RV, a camping trailer that's not lived in full time. And they applied it to something that now is becoming more of a regular living situation. And so in the beginning, trying to find all that information, like I phoned a few of the tiny home builders, and the thing with tiny home builders companies is they hold their cards very close to their chest. Mm-hmm. Not all of them, but a lot of them do. They're secrets because it's a really fresh industry. It's really new. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they don't want everyone doing this. They don't want to lose market share. And I mean, I get that. But the only way to really breed ingenuity is to share your ideas and to develop ways of doing things so that, you know, the industry can grow as a whole, which helps everybody. Mm-hmm. But okay, so that's this kind of old boys club idea. And that's the way I kind of look at it, you know, this old school way of certification. And it's a good thing because it does give tiny home builders an avenue in our country to be able to do this, to be able to put them on the market in a safe and built well manner.
Just so it's not a free for all.
Exactly. It's not just doing whatever you want and then, you know, not having proper regress or alarms or certain ways of doing stuff or testing things. But with that said, you know, like I said before, they don't really look at every unit. So really, how do they know exactly what units are going out in a certain way? Mm-hmm. So I didn't like that part of it, but I felt that, you know, if that's the way to do it, then that's the way we have to do it. And then I came across in one of my many nights of rabbit holing in the internet, I came across a company in the United States called NOAA. This is a alternative living certification company. This is all they do is they certify alternative living, sea cans, houseboats,
oh, cool.
Tiny homes. And their program is based directly around a set of codes that they've developed, in conjunction with, US certification. I can't NAPH, NPH. And so they develop this system and these codings based around actual tiny homes. So they tell you like you have to have hurricane ties in this many places and all of that. You know, it takes away a little bit of freedom. But the cool thing about them is that they do inspections on every unit and they do multiple inspections through the time. And it's all done through Skype or Teams or online. And you get on a video call with an inspector and you walk him through when you're doing the electrical, you're doing the plumbing, you're doing the framing, you're doing all that. I think there's 8 different stages of it. And he takes those inspections and gives you a pass or tells you what he feels you need to do to make them better, just like when building a house. Mm-hmm. But he looks at every single unit 8 different times as they're being built. I really liked that. I really liked the idea of them seeing and being a part of every single build. The other cool thing about NOAA is that all of those videos are saved into a file, which goes on with the tiny home. So as the client purchases the tiny home, they can go back and watch all of the videos of the inspections and be able to see what needed to be changed and how you changed it and what you did to correct it, or if you were able to meet their codings through the building process. So I really think that that is kind of the forward thinking that I enjoy about this industry. You know, they are a very, they put a lot of thought into how they should do that. And I'm very happy that there is somebody out there who's thinking of doing something this way, as opposed to just going with what is available. They're trying to create better builds and better builders and holding you accountable as through the build. And I really think that that's the way this industry should look at in certification.
Now, is that like a national, this NOAA out of the States, is it recognized in Canada, or is it its own unique kind of sector that it's hitting on?
It's recognized in Canada. Now, when I say it's recognized in Canada, it's because the insurance company accepts it as a certification.
Oh, cool. That's okay. Good. Yeah.
Yeah. So certification is really just based around, like, the government doesn't demand certification to build this like it does with a house. Mm-hmm. So there's no government body that will swoop in and tell you that you can't do this because you're not being certified, like a permit, for example, you know, like mm-hmm. something like that. There's no real permits that are pulled to do this. My electricians pulled a permit, just tried to anyways, and they the guy at the permit office was like, I don't know how to permit this, but you know, so like, but what they did is there was no physical permit pulled, but they kind of did it just like a normal permit would be done.
Yeah.
And there was no permit signed at the end, but they followed the process of the permit, of how a permit would be pulled.
So probably just due to the evolving industry, hey, like, because this is kind of a fresh and unique, and maybe some municipalities or towns, cities haven't really dealt with a lot of this. They're probably, I mean, I guess there's got to be a starting point somewhere, right?
Yeah, exactly. And then, so the certification is really based around finance and insurance. So that's what the certifications are really meant for. They're meant to be able, so people, like, they're meant to drive an insurance company into being comfortable, and the municipalities, like you said, being comfortable getting in bed into an industry that is really, like I said earlier, gray and covered with dark clouds. There's not a lot of like layout for it. But a lot of tiny home builders don't want that evolution to happen because they're established in a certain way. They are building them in a certain way. Mm. Their companies are built around a certain way of doing things, and change is hard for them. Mm-hmm. When I started looking into this and learning more about it, I felt like I wanted to be a part of the other team and help drive this industry into a more established way of doing things. I don't want them to be cookie cutter by any means, but there's no reason that someone shouldn't look over them as you build them to make sure that you're doing these things right. And, you know, especially now that tiny homes, like everything else, they're not cheap to build, you know, that's another part that's very hard in this industry, is people have always looked at tiny homes as the cheap alternative to housing. But when you buy one from somebody who built them, you know, and they have to follow certain codes, they do get very expensive because you have to do things in a certain way, in a certain manner. You can't just use what you have on hand. You have to buy and purchase the proper products, like GRKs and hurricane ties and, you know, all of those types of things that can cost some money. So it's pushing the tiny home industry into, you know, costing more. You know, your average tiny home probably goes for about $150,000 now. But if that's the case and people are paying that kind of money, the industry needs to make sure that those people are getting a product that's high quality, made well, and will last them a very long time. That's kind of the certification end of it.
Just kind of like the residential housing, right? There's permits, there's certain ways or certain codes, I guess, that you need to follow. It sounds like you're under the mindset of being a part of that change and to get kind of a, I guess if you want to call it, a governing body that is involved. Because if you're, you know, if you can go buy a house, say for, well, now let's throw numbers out, say $400,000 for a house, or maybe $250,000 for a tiny home. If I'm spending, you know, whether it's a house or a tiny home, I want to make sure that it's built properly. So by having, you know, certification and having that NOAA company involved at the different steps. As a customer or potential customer, if I can see videos and see the certification and stuff, I think I'm going to feel a lot better spending my money on something that I know was built to, I guess, code or with the proper...
Some sort of standard.
Yeah, you know, some sort... Yeah, I guess some sort of standard in place. Whereas if it's not, then how do you know you're getting a good product? It might look really nice, but that first winter when you're, you know, out off the grid and stuff starts freezing up or your heater doesn't work because it wasn't plumbed in properly, like, I don't know. I feel like that being on that side of the pendulum that you are wanting to hopefully evolve the industry, I think that's just going to better everybody and kind of give a standard moving forward. And yes, it might be change is hard for everybody. I guess it depends on how you handle it. And maybe for some larger businesses that are, you know, very much production of these, that might, you know, change their workflow. But I don't know. I feel like as a consumer or a customer, I guess, I would like to know, just like buying a house, is the framing done properly? Is the foundation, the plumbing and heating, all that stuff needs to, I guess, hold a certain standard to be comfortable?
Absolutely, yep. And we want more consumers. We want more people doing this. We have a huge amount of people entering our country every day. Mm-hmm. We have a huge housing crisis that is happening in our country right now. The government's main focus in the next election will be housing. That will be the main platform for all of them. We want to try and develop a way to be able to give the common person somewhere that they can invest in a home that they can live in. You know, rent is rent and it will always be there, but you don't really... In our society, you don't really feel like you've come up until you bought your first home, right? That's what we strive for, is to purchase our first home.
Yeah.
And when we're eliminating that first home step for a lot of young kids, it's going away. They can't come out of university, work for 3 or 4 years and buy $500,000 home. Yeah. That $500,000 home for me when I was coming out of university was only $100,000. So we were able to afford our $1,300 a month home payment. You know, so we can do that. So I'm hoping that we'll be able to develop a way of being able to supply not only new homeowners, but also new people to this country, immigrants and things like that, that are need a place to live, you know, that need a place to stay, that want to start their lives here in this country and help build our country to what we hope it will be. That those are just very, very, that's a small kind of portion of the consumer that we've researched, but without guideline, we can't build the $85,000 tiny homes anymore. Like it's impossible. You know, the $100 isn't worth what $100 was 2 years ago. Mm. And it's not going to get that way again. You know, big corporations in our Western world will never allow that to happen. You know, they like the fact that things cost so much money. So it probably won't get better. But we can come up with ideas to be able to give the people, some of the consumers, some of the, you know, generations that are coming up, my kids, your kids, opportunity to take a first step. And it may be something as simple as, and we want to encourage people to live with what they need, not with what they want. We have lived our lives as consumers for so long, and in our day to day, you know, our society is a consumption society, and our earth, our planet, our well-being, you know, we can't do that. It doesn't feel comfortable to walk into your garage and it's just full of shit, so much stuff, you know, it doesn't feel good, right?
When you need to purge 8-10 times a year, you know, this minimalist thinking, to be honest, or I guess, to be honest, it scares the shit out of me because I'm like, well, I've got all this stuff, but it's stuff. And I think if you can get under the mindset of being able to purge that, or whether it's, you know, starting fresh with something like a tiny house like this, you'd probably be amazed at how little you can live with and still be happy, still, you know, come home from work and enjoy life. And you don't need to have, like you said, the garage that's full of crap. You know, I think this is something that's going to, you know, steer people into maybe thinking about the planet and living differently. I mean, when I look at tiny homes and stuff and even just talking, I'm like, how can I declutter my house? And, you know, everybody wants a bigger house and more toys and all this stuff, but you get rid of that stuff and it's the focal point in there. It's, you know, being around your friends and family and using the space to be efficient. And like I said, it scares the shit out of me to, you know, contemplate even living in one of these, but I think it would be good for everybody to experience it.
Just I think to show I'd love it.
That you don't need much. Here's
as long as there's a big Quanta beside it.
Yeah, yeah. You need a shop that you can do some work in, right? But yeah, I don't know. It seems like talking with you and all the research you've done and the design, like we're going through your Instagram here as we're kind of chatting, and the mechanical room off the front there. Like,
can you see it?
Yeah, it's and I've been following this since you kind of started throwing the, or since I guess Humblebee Instagram was created and kind of your journey, and just looking at it, it looks like a piece of art that you have spent a ton of time designing and figuring out to maximize things. And it's not your conventional tiny home in a good way. It's very sleek and modern, and the rainwater system, like you have been grinding with this, and it definitely shows just from looking at, I mean, not even being in it, but looking at the pictures, there's definitely been a lot of thought and time taken in to develop this masterpiece here.
Yeah, it's like I said in the beginning, I wanted to build furniture for a living, and this is like taking all of the things I've learned over the years and trying to build a piece of furniture, you know, something that is very taken a lot of, it's meticulous and time consuming, and making jigs for this and making, you know, it's building furniture on a larger scale, coming up with solutions for storage and space and what would look funny, you know, like when you build a piece of furniture, you can't just inlay a walnut up a leg because, you know, you think maybe that'll be all right. You got to like actually picture it and how it'll look, and you got to fit it just right, and it's got to be good. But at the same time, you want that creative freedom to just flow. And so when I first started thinking about doing this, I locked myself away from tiny home websites. I would not go on them. I would not look at tiny homes when I was designing it. My 3 months I spent designing it on SketchUp, I wouldn't go anywhere near what a tiny home looked like. I didn't want to look inside and see how people had done this or people had done that. I wanted to just kind of let it flow out of me and see if I could create something that was different or if it ended up the same. Mm-hmm. And that was a really fun part. And I want to continue that with Humblebee. I want to, you know, try to build a lot of tiny home builders build models, the 5 models. These are the models you get to choose from. Most likely we will have some of that, but I want it to be a little bit more like, I don't know what the word is, architectural and different. And I want people to be like, oh, that's a Humblebee tiny home. You know, yeah. You can just kind of tell from its presence. And
would you ever dabble in container stuff?
Yeah, I'm not a welder. So that's fair. The hardest part about the container stuff. There's a lot of welding that goes on when you do. I have welding experience and a welder. But I wouldn't be confident enough with it to be able to put it together. But I wouldn't say no to it. And I did kind of build a container home. My storage, when I first leased a piece of property to store all my DC Scott construction stuff in, we kind of turned a shipping container into like a little home. Like it's a storage unit, but it's fully insulated. It's got solar lights in it. It's got heaters and it's got all of those things in it. So
that's awesome. So when we talk about grind time, which it sounds like you've been grinding on this, this build for quite a while. You obviously, like you had mentioned, you know, you didn't want to have outside influence when you were designing. And then dealing with your customer or your client who kind of gave you freedom. When you run into challenges or problems, how do you overcome that? And how do you stay in, like, describe that process and the mindset that you get into and how you overcome those problems when you're just thrashing away and grinding on a, you know, this sounds like it's been a project for quite a while. Can you explain kind of how you overcome those challenges?
Yeah, absolutely. So my take on it is there's always the next day. So when I come to a situation where my water pump isn't functioning the way I want it to, you know, this appliance or fixture isn't functioning in the way that I was anticipating, I'll spend some time with it. And, you know, it usually gets me pretty riled up, but, you know, I will spend days leaving it alone. And usually when you walk away from something and you kind of put it in the drawer, that's when your kind of solutions come to terms. And then I'll try 10 different things until it works right. I can't leave it alone forever. You know, I can't just be like, that's good enough. That's not in my wheelhouse. I'm not like that. It has to be multiple layers of protection. It has to be, you know, twice as much insulated ability. You know, I have to be able to know that when I pass this on to my client, that it has multiple layers of protection from failing. So I think that when it comes to problem solving, especially in the build of the tiny home, it was a lot of just kind of moving on to the next thing for a minute and kind of letting it stew for a while until, because when you go back to it, a really good example is when you're online looking for something, in particular, my heat exchanger. I couldn't buy a 1500 square foot heat exchanger to put in this thing because it would just turn it into a vacuum when it started moving. I spent multiple nights online trying to find this thing. And then I put it away for a minute and I moved on to it. And a couple of weeks later, I went back online and instantly found the one I wanted to find.
You know, isn't that crazy how that works? Hey, just need to just take a step back and away you go.
Kind of think about the problem or just let it, leave it alone. And then usually when you address it again, you can look at it and be like, oh yeah, that's why it's not functioning. And it was the same way with certification and insurance. You know, there was a lot of time spent and a lot of nights upset that I couldn't find the avenues to those things on my own. It's not easy. But like I said, once I just left it alone, then it just kind of came and the problem was solved. Once you step back into it, you can see it a little clearer. Then when you get frustrated with things and your mind gets foggy, you don't think straight. The problems usually aren't solved in that moment. And the tiny house really taught me that I needed to put things away in a drawer for a few minutes and then look at them again later. And that's usually when the problems can be solved.
Probably easier said than done with that. I think it's, you know, when you get frustrated or if you're heated about, you know, whether it's a build or something that's not going right, just to be able to
snow.
Yeah, exactly. Be able to put it away and not think about it. Especially with timeline stuff is probably very difficult. But like you were saying, I think that time taken away from it almost gives your brain and your mindset a bit of a reset to go back into it, maybe with a fresh outlook or even just bringing that emotion down so that you can go kind of calm and collected and try and resolve it instead of just fighting and being pissed off all the time.
Yeah. My wife tells my kids that same thing every day. You know, you can't, when you're upset and you're in a moment, you can't solve your problems. You can't. You're not going
to
do it.
Your brain's literally not working how it's supposed to.
Yeah.
You're right. And you can't even think straight enough to solve, like speak clearly, let alone solve a problem.
There's definitely some times in this build where I felt that way.
Can you give us a specific?
Yeah, there's so many aspects in it.
There's so many of them. Actually, I'm just kidding.
Cutting the metal was one of them. You know, you ask a friend, you know, I have a friend of mine who does metal roofing all the time. How do you cut this stuff? Because like, for example, when it goes around the flashing on the window, the cut is right in exposed. You know, when it goes into the side of the window, it's covered, so it's not as crucial. But there's parts of it that when we were wrapping it that are exposed cuts. And so you start looking at tools to be able to make it better, to make the cuts more proper and appear better and look better. And so I tried a few tools. You know, there's a thing called a nibbler, mm-hmm. and it's a little pin that drops down and you go through and you can cut with it. But we had a lot of trouble with this thing, you know, like I'm used to track saws where I can put my saw down on a piece of wood and it's deadly straight. There's nothing like that for metal. It's that I found anyways. So we found the grinder was our best tool. You know, we just used a grinder and we figured out how to cut these things appropriately without burning edges, the time it took. But we spent a lot of time. Oh, I have another really good example. The gas pistons on the doghouse. So the front of the doghouse, that's what we call the front end of where the mechanical room is. Mm-hmm. We needed to insulate that.
So the door was 300 pounds. And so like we tried to calculate where, like what the pistons were needed for this thing. And I had ordered one size and I'd ordered another size and even positioning these pistons, it's, you have to be so accurate with where you position these pistons on the door and on the frame. And we probably spent, you know, the equivalent of a whole day just trying to figure out how to get these pistons to function properly so that when a client would open the door, it would just open for them. There was no like, and then sealing it at the same time, because that was the hardest part, is that those pistons, that air lock that would happen, you know, It was very difficult to get the door to open. And, but we did it. And it just, again, I had to just step away from it and, you know, try a few things. And now it functions beautifully. It's
trial and error sometimes, hey?
Yep. One of my favorite parts is that doghouse for sure.
That's awesome. So as we kind of wrap up here, Dennis, we usually kind of ask our three ending questions here. What advice do you have somebody who would like to get into the construction industry? I mean, you've got a huge background of, you know, everything could be renovations. What's some advice you have for somebody wanting to get started in the industry?
Drink in as much knowledge as you can. Spend your time researching the things that you do. Ask a lot of questions.
Ask questions. That is so important.
Do you find a lot of the like young kids will say coming in, are they the ones that you see, are they more likely to ask questions and be kind of humble, or are they come in a little more prideful and think that they want you to think that they know everything, or is there like a mix?
Very timid. The new kids are a very timid generation. They're not comfortable speaking up. They're not comfortable telling somebody that they don't know what they're doing and they need to learn. They'll spend an hour or two trying to figure it out so that they don't have to ask.
Yes. So I see that every day. Like,
and they're getting paid. They're getting paid though. The ones in the school, you're like, they're come paid. On, yeah. Just ask a question here, right?
But his kids are like, sorry, like today, sorry. Like, it's literally my job to show you how to do this. Yeah. Don't say sorry. Yeah. Thank you. It's like job security for me. I don't know. Like, what do you?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, man. And so it's a learning curve for me as well to try and kind of figure out how to, there's a lot of, what would be the right word to use? Like, it takes a little bit of coddling with the new generation. You can't just be abrupt and yelly. You have to be patient and calm and let them evolve a little bit. One of my employees does very well when he's left alone to figure it out with a little bit of guidance. But I've had other ones that, you know, they need to be watched and taught very physically and very in with them, and you have to make sure that you're doing what you can to show them that it's okay to be comfortable, you know, saying I don't know what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
absolutely. So what are some more specific skill sets you would recommend someone coming into the industry to like really hone?
That's a tough one. It's hard to say what I do because we do so many different things. We're not always doing the same thing every day.
And they can be they can be general skill sets too. Like
learn to read a tape measure. You'd be shocked at how many kids come through that have no idea how to read a tape measure. That's for all the parents out there too. Teach your kids how to read tape measures.
One tick past.
Wait, what? 7 and 8 ticks. All right, let's. This is what I'm working with, so we'll make it work.
Put the big inch thing on the wall.
The guy worked for me one time. My uncle, you know him very well, Corey.
Yes.
he would call them squigglies. So we would have to say, you know, 1 and 6 squigglies or whatever. And so,
hey, sometimes you come with a system again, systems, right? Putting systems in place. I mean, do you fight with having to teach how to read a tape measure, or do you, you know, when you're getting paid per job, do you work with a system that's going to work and everybody can, you know, efficiently move on?
Yeah, exactly. So that's a big one for sure. It's something I ask a lot about when I'm interviewing people for the business, if that's something that you're capable of doing. And most people are pretty honest about it, you know. Mm-hmm. I do or I don't. And if it's a no, but I'm still interested in them, that's the first thing I ask of them, is to go and research how to like properly read it. So when I tell you I want, you know, 30 seconds or 16ths or whatever it may be, that you're capable of knowing that. The other one is an impact. An impact's a very common tool in what I do, and that's something that a lot of my guys struggle with a lot. It's something I never really realized that it's a difficult tool to use. You can grind and fall off and then really make big mistakes with the end of your driver bit if you're not using it properly. So
that's a good point.
Yeah.
I never thought about that
clutch. I remember starting in the cabinet trade. I had an old Mastercraft drill, 19.2 volt, and it was wonderful. I grew up with drills because impacts weren't really a thing back then. And then getting my first impact and drill, and that clutch, when it hits, or that impact, and the, I guess from the clutch, it moves things. You know, when you have things clamped and everything's nice, you drive a screw into two cabinets to screw them together. That play even can sometimes kick something out too, right?
Oh,
and it's just, I don't know. They are, now that you bring it up, I just, you know, you kind of deal with it, but they are tricky for, and I look back at my classes now, and there's a lot of kids that struggle with impacts. And
it's about positioning. And I teach my guys that a lot. You have to get your body positioned properly when you go to drive that screw. Because if you're not, if you're holding it funny or you're not putting pressure in the right places. And I take it for granted because it's been a tool in my hand all the time. So I can pick it up in any position and it goes in the right way. But, you know, that's something that we struggle a lot with new guys, is that use, because it's a tool we use all the time, is figuring out how to position your body properly and your arms properly to get that screw to go the way you want it to.
And you don't come off of it and jam your Phillips bit into the drywall and you got this big hole you got to patch.
Yeah, more work.
Yeah. So last question here. What would be your top three starting out tools? I think I know like what one is already.
Tools?
Actual tools.
you need an impact, definitely. You need a multi-tool. That is a tool that is used way more. When that multi-tool came out and Gerald bought that Freud multi-tool, you know, it was a dream come true for cabinet installers and any industry, really. Construction industry,
right? Yeah, many uses.
That multi-tool is one of, and the laser.
Yeah,
you know, those are my three top tools for sure. The laser, the multi-tool, and the laser have changed our industry substantially. Cabinets installation for sure. I can go in and install a kitchen with that laser. There's no more guessing, you know, there's no more rocking of the levels. You put it on, you level your cabinets to it, and you know that it's going to be perfect in the end. You put a 24 inch level on a cabinet from one side to the other, and then you move to the next one. There's always room for error. Mm-hmm. And by the time you get down at the end of your 12 foot run, you could be up an eighth of an inch. With the laser, it eliminates all that. So, and it's kind of neat because those were tools that, you know, we never really foreseen as becoming what they are now. But evolving from the simple tools back in my uncle's shop, like you said, just a normal drill, or trying to figure out how to use a jigsaw and cut it properly. The multi-tool and the laser and the impact have really changed the cabinet industry, installation end of it, so much.
Mm-hmm. So like rotary laser, do you do the three planes, or would it just be your horizontal and vertical?
Horizontal and vertical, yeah. So most of the lasers come with three. Two vertical and one horizontal. Okay. We use multiple lasers. I have multiple lasers that I use, so there'll be multiple setup usually. When we tile, we use them a lot as well. We use a rotary laser. It's more like, what are they called now? I don't like the name for them. But we use them when we build decks. So we set up a rotary tool, and then we have a capture. It's like a beeper, and then so it goes on a stick. It's not service. That's bothering me now. I can't remember the name of it. But anyways, so we use that when we build decks to level a more larger surface, where you don't have to be super accurate. But you know, again, like you're trying to run a 6 foot, 10 foot level that over one joist, where with this rotary laser, we can keep it set up all the time and constantly check.
So, yeah. Game changer. Nice. I like those tool suggestions.
You gonna buy some now?
Maybe. I've got a laser. I've got an impact multi-tool. The nice thing with the multi-tools, and I guess all tools, is the cordless capabilities, right? They've got the cordless. I know Milwaukee has the M12 lasers. Most, I think Makita, DeWalt, they all have the cordless multi-tools. Even just the cordless part, the cordless side of, you know, the next generation of tools, that's a game changer to be able to pull up and not have to remember the old days of there might used to be one plug in a condo up in Fernie. You're trying to, you know, you had three extension cords in your boom box to give you, you know, more outlets, and it was just a nightmare. Or you didn't have homes sometimes that had power, and now you can set, you know, lights up and have little generators, and it's crazy to see. Yeah. Compressors, there's cordless compressors now. Like, it's phenomenal to see. I would love to go back in time to go back to the installing side with all, and even track saws now, you know, scribing panels to walls or whatnot. Before you used to jigsaw, belt sand. Now you can just put your tracks on, get it close, finish it up. And it's like, oh man, I feel like we missed out a bit.
Maybe the track saw replaces the impact. I never really thought of the track saw. That is definitely like one of my favorite tools. I love that thing. We use it for, I have a router attachment for it as well. Mm-hmm. So we use that track saw. I replace those rubber pads on that track saw like every month. Like we use it so much, that track saw. I love it. And the dust collection systems that come with that track saw, like it sucks every ounce of fiber out of those things and it gets nowhere. And so now, instead of having to drag panels outside, we can cut them right in the homes.
Yeah. What kind of track saw do you run?
I run all black and yellow. And it's funny because it's the batteries. And those companies, those tools we buy are just vessels for selling batteries. That's where those companies make money. And then once you buy a few batteries, you're kind of stuck with that, you know, over the years. But I always found that DeWalt, like when we were in school, my teacher was really big on certain brands for certain tools. Mm-hmm. Like for example, the Festool, you can't beat a Festool's drywall sander. You know, Milwaukee makes an amazing corded circular saw. You know, I've never found that, like I really feel that Makita makes some of the best drills and impacts, but you can't do that. Like I can't have two batteries for this and two batteries for that and two batteries for that. And those companies that's kind of based around, I mean, my lawnmower, my whippersnipper, it's all DeWalt stuff because that's the type of batteries I have. So you just kind of get caught. It depends on whatever your first battery is really where it really leads you to.
Or you have the money to be able to upgrade and go spend $3,000 on getting new batteries and chargers to be able to, you know, finance the one-off tools that you want.
Yeah, that's like 15 batteries these days.
Yeah, exactly.
Not even that many.
No.
Yeah.
Oh man. Yeah. Well, Dennis, this has been awesome. I really appreciate you coming on, taking the time to catch up with Hoff over here, and to kind of share your story. And, you know, I would have loved to be there when you dumped that, all that snow on his car. Did you use like a loader?
No, we shoveled it. We had to shovel the parking lot, so we just moved it all onto his car.
But then I think it warmed up a little bit and then got colder because we got back late, so it kind of froze. About it, now I brought it up. So now I'm gonna go talk to my kids tomorrow and be like, you know what? It's a good prank. Load up your buddy's car with snow.
Then they'll do it to your truck.
Yeah, probably. Really
There's no pictures of it. I don't know. Like, if we had phones, like, it's not like it was like that back then. And, you know, we didn't have phones to snap pictures of everything. So
it's all memories, right? That's the better way to do it sometimes.
So as we kind of close up here, what's next and where can people find you?
What's next? So just to kind of keep it simple, we're working with that same fellow right now that bought this tiny home. He's looking at buying some property, and we're looking at building a village. So we're going to start with 10. We're working on it. Nothing's for sure. Municipalities make it very difficult to do these things, and it takes time. He's also 65 years old, so who knows where that will lead him. So we're hoping that that's where it's going to go. I'm going to keep, you know, grinding away at Humblebee and just let it kind of evolve in the same way I did when I designed it. I just want it to, you know, kind of do a natural flow. I find that businesses are stronger after 5 or 10 years when they're not forced, when mm-hmm. they're just kind of, you know, and DC Scott does very well. So I'm in no hurry to, build this thing. I want it to kind of evolve on its own, and I'm hoping, and I'm gonna work hard at it, and I hope that that's something that I do full-time in the future, is that I get to build these tiny homes, these pieces of furniture, these pieces of art every day.
Love it. And where can people find like social media, that type of websites, where can people find you?
We are on our biggest base is Instagram. Humblebee Builds on Instagram. Our website, humblebeebuilds.com. We're also on Facebook because it's a natural evolution from Instagram. We do some TikToks, a very small amount. It's not something that we've really got into. There's so many out there. Yeah. So you kind of just got to pick a few and focus on them.
Yeah.
But we find that most people are most comfortable with Instagram. That's one of those ones that people just kind of go on and check it out and then go off. It's not something like, you know, constant ads or videos, or you don't get caught up in it. So we kind of felt like that was a good social platform for us to be able to present what we were doing and how we were doing it, and help other people who might be interested in doing this as well. That's one big part of what we plan to do in the future, is to educate people on this so that there can be more of the industry, which means more consumers, which means it's better for everybody.
I love it. Love the sustainability focus. I love the bee focus. I love, the whole vision behind it. It's so nice to, it's refreshing to meet. Whenever we talk to a builder who has some intention behind what they do and not just to make a buck, it's really cool. So I just want to say that and commend you on that. And thank you once again for taking time out of your schedule to come on the show. We really appreciate it. We'll put all the show notes in the show notes. We'll put all the links to all your social media and everything like that. But thanks again so much, Dennis, for coming on. It's been great.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Hoff.
Thanks, Rosie.
And thanks, everyone, for listening, and we'll catch you in the next one.